first time in Mark's Gospel, Jesus tells his disciples where it is that he is going. And he's moving out of Galilee and he's turned his face toward Jerusalem. And you can almost feel a chill descend upon the text, because we know that the journey to Jerusalem is also the journey to the cross. Now, the idea of a journey is a very good way of telling the story of Jesus, because Jesus is always on his way somewhere else. We read throughout Mark's Gospel that Jesus did this or that and then immediately went on somewhere else. And you get the image of the disciples as a group of people who are always breathlessly trying to keep up and catch up with Jesus. You recall the story where Jesus calls Andrew and Peter. They were at work one day, mending their nets, when Jesus calls them, "Come, follow me," and immediately, without even asking who this man is or what he's about, they begin the journey. But what about that episode when the disciples are out on the boat in the sea, and a storm blows in, and the sea gets ugly, and it appears the boat is going to be swamped, and everyone will drown? And lo, walking on the sea is Jesus. Mark says the disciples first spot him walking past their little boat. And then there's a time when the women come to the tomb on Easter morning, and by the time they get there, they're greeted by a young man in white who tells them that they've just missed Jesus, that he's on his way to Galilee. So Jesus tells his disciples this morning that the Son of Man must journey to Jerusalem and suffer, be crucified and buried, and rise again on the third day. Think of discipleship as a journey with Jesus. And here are a couple observations that have occurred to me about the journey. First, the journey with Jesus is not only an adventure, it is a relationship. Being a disciple of Jesus is not just about getting your head around a list of fundamental beliefs. Discipleship is more than a head trip. Discipleship is more than memorizing or underlining Bible verses. The Christian life is best understood as walking in relationship with Jesus. Secondly, a journey implies movement from here to there. And it's impossible to journey if you're stuck in a rut or sitting still. So we're saying that the journey will involve change and that it will be a long process. Thirdly, as with any journey, there will be times when we wonder if we're getting anywhere. We'll have setbacks and detours and long stretches perhaps of boredom when the scenery is not too interesting. Christian journey, there are peaks and there are valleys. We're called to just keep walking. And the journey requires certain disciplines. Discipline and disciple, remember, come from the same root. Perhaps your journey with Jesus began as a flash of light and great enthusiasm, but over time, the enthusiasm wanes. The journey of faith becomes less exciting. The church that we enjoyed attending during the first few months becomes dull and routine. It's always important to keep active. And the church holds up before us, especially in Lent, the disciplines of prayer and fasting and almsgiving and study. These are habits to keep us focused. Sunday worship is a discipline. Some people say they feel that God is absent from them, but they don't ever stop to think about the times that they've been absent from God. Just getting out of bed, getting dressed, and coming to church, even when the time changes, don't knock it, because it's an important discipline. So with all that out of the way, I want to give you a brief little roadmap of Christian life. 7 stages on the Christian journey. And they're not my steps, but they're the collective wisdom of the saints throughout the ages. And the purpose of these steps is to help us chart our progress, to let us know how far we've come and how far we need to go. And knowing them helps us from sliding back and pressing on toward the goal of the journey, which is eternal life with God. So listen carefully and try to figure out where it is that you are. The first step is populated by people that we might call nasty. They are people whose fundamental orientation of life is me first, and they show this. They are obviously selfish, unkind, and unhelpful. Secondly, there are the nice people, who are the kind of delightful people that you want at your cocktail party, but who really follow the same philosophy of me first. But to amuse or pacify or please others, they've learned some manners and some social skills. They are socially converted. And some people mistakenly equate Christianity with this kind of conversion. Be polite, take your hat off when you eat, phone your mother once a week. Of course, Jesus was not particularly interested in pacifying, amusing, or pleasing others. And neither were most of his saints. The third stage is what we might call moral conversion. These people have begun to learn the virtue of unselfishness. Sure enough, they continue to look out for number one, but occasionally they'll check in with other people to make sure that they're not being overtly offensive. Fourthly, we have minimally religious people. They check in with God every once in a while. They go to church from time to time. They try to avoid sin. They pray once in a while. But deepest in their heart is still their own pleasure and advantage, their own will, and their own way. Now, I've told you before of this example, but it's the best one I can think of, so hear it again. When I was in Dallas, in my parish, we had a choir member who made a request that the parish pay for her babysitter while she attended choir practice. Well, the vestry said no, they really didn't want to start that precedent. 2 days later, she was in my office screaming at me that since she had to pay for her babysitter from her money, she and her husband would henceforth deduct the cost of their babysitting from their pledge to the church. Now, do you see the underlying philosophy there? It was her money, not God's, her money, and she resented having to parcel out more of her money to God and his church. So for the minimally religious person, faith in Jesus is fine as long as it doesn't prove inconvenient. The fifth stage sees the beginning of personal conversion. Here we begin to fight the battle with ourselves, though the victory is not yet won. St. Paul describes this when he says, you know, the good that I want to do, I don't do. But instead, I do the very thing that I hate. There's a war going on inside between our will and God's will. The sixth step is that God is no longer the master of our souls, but God has actually allowed to come in and displace us as master, piece by piece, area by area. We've seriously begun to do what Jesus calls us to do, namely take up our cross and deny ourselves and follow. And where God was once only the master of Sunday morning, now he's the master of Monday old self still gives trouble, but only as a rebellious servant and not as master. And the seventh, the last stage, is doing God's will only. Thy will, not my will, be done. In other words, the self has been killed. We have lost our life for God's sake, and in the process have saved our own life. Stage seven is heavenly life, and very few of us will attain it in the here and now. But of His mercy, God has provided it that we might continue to grow in His love and service in the next life, until we reach heaven at last. So there you have a roadmap of walking with Jesus. It can be heartening to see how far we've come. It can be frightening to see how far back we can fall. And it's also useful for mapping out our future journey. The book of Acts says that the first name given to Christians was the Way. The Way. And that's a really good name. To be a disciple means to be someone who is following Jesus on the way. And that is why we keep Lent for a short, concentrated 40 days. You and I can really, really work on our journey with Jesus. We stand in the words of the Nicene Creed.